Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 128 of Connectivity. I am Scott Thompson. Today we have three regular segments for you and then a bonus segment at the end of the show. Kicking things off, myself and Neil sit down with Jules from Renegade Kid to talk all about the Kickstarter for the upcoming game Colt County. After that, Alex has a small prediction segment all about what to expect from next week's Nintendo Direct all about Smash Brothers. And closing out the regular show, myself and Neil do a little segment about Pokemon Battle Troze. And after the outro, stick around for a bonus segment all about the disappointing finale to How I Met Your Mother. That's with Zach and Neil. Enjoy. Hey, and welcome to Connectivity, where we are with Jules Watcham from Renegade Kid.
Hi.
I'm Neil Ronahan, and with me is Scott Thompson.
Hello.
And we're going to talk all about Jules' new Kickstarter campaign for Colt County. So I guess before we kind of get started into the conversation, Jules, what exactly is your Kickstarter and its plan?
As you said, it's for Colt County, for home consoles and home computers. And the main reason for that is, you know, we're using the Unity engine, which obviously allows us to support multiple platforms apart from 3DS, unfortunately, which I'm sure we'll get to. The plan is it's a survival horror first person shooter. It's kind of our way of returning to the genre that kind of birthed Renegade Kid back in, 7 years ago in 2007.
Wow.
Well, yeah, right. with Dementium the Ward. So it's our way
back
of getting back
to
that.
Back in the Gamecock days.
It's that, yeah, exactly. We're unable to do Dementium 3 because of contractual ickiness. So we're like, all right, fine. We'll just do a new one then. and it did start off as a 3DS game. You saw it last PAX on the 3DS.
Yeah.
And since then, we didn't do any more progression on the actual game itself on the 3DS as far as game assets, but we continued with the story, the characters, game design kind of ideas. And then that kind of led us down the path of considering console and Unity. And also in combination, and what contributed to that thought as well, is because we just finished up episode 1 of Moon Chronicles. Yay! for the 3DS.
Is there a release date?
No, not yet. No, we submitted it to Nintendo. It came back with a couple of buggeroonies. So we're getting those fixed up. I think actually they were already fixed up, but today was so crazy with the launch of Kickstarter, we didn't have much chance to look at that. But the programmer said, yeah, I think we're good. And I'm like, well, I'll get to that tomorrow, unfortunately, because today's kind of nuts. But I think we're good to go to resubmit it to them. And the good news on that is the bugs that Nintendo found were really minor.
Yeah, no, that's good. I've seen a couple Wii U developers be set back way farther because of just finding bugs that then kind of cripple everything.
Yeah, no, it can be very challenging. No, I mean, our guys are amazing. I'm not the programmer, so I can't take any credit for it. The programmers we have are really just... they're really smart, and they're very, the way that when they implement stuff, they don't just put it in and go, oh, I'll fix all the bugs, the rough edges later. They're very cautious, and they're very anal, where they clean up behind them as they go. So when we get to this point, testing, we had like 70 or 80 bugs, and that's even including silly minor things, you know, nothing like major city, yeah. Like, oh, I need to move this over there or whatever. So we had a pretty minimal, list of bugs really, and, internally. Before Nintendo got it, but it did really well. Anyway, off track there for a little bit.
Yeah.
But that was a contributing factor to why we thought, hey, let's go big, you know, with Colt County, with consoles and computers, and use Unity, which is just really exciting. It's a different, new, exciting kind of thing for us to jump into.
Yeah,
so that's what it is.
This is the first time you're using the Unity engine, right?
I mean, we have used it, but we haven't released a game.
So you've been kind of experimenting with it.
Yeah, exactly. We've been doing some ninja development in the background. and it is fantastic. I love it. It's a really nice program, getting in there and being able to edit the parameters and move things around and lighting and applying things. It's really, really nice. Really, really nice. And you can also always test it on the PC, of course, for really quick iterative cycles. So you can make a small change, press a button, boom, play it. Oh, yeah, cool. And it's really, really nice. And obviously, like I said before, it supports multiple platforms. So the platforms, obviously, I know we're focusing mainly on Wii U today. because it's Nintendo World Report.
Indeed.
But there are other platforms.
Which, I mean, it's kind of exciting that you guys are releasing on pretty much everything. Xbox One, PC,
yeah.
PS4, PS3, and Vita, right?
Yes.
And in addition to Wii U.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Which is
there have
exciting.
Been some rumblings lately that Unity might come to 3DS.
Yeah, no, Damon Barker?
I think so.
One of those two. Super nice guy. I actually met him at the last Nintendo press thing we did. Yeah, I saw him talking about it recently, and that would be fantastic. I mean, if it did come to the 3DS, that would be really, really awesome. Honestly, I'm a little, you know, it could be interesting because an engine like Unity has a lot of overhead as far as the flexibility comes at a cost of it's not optimized for one device.
Yeah.
Which is the beautiful thing about it if you have powerful machines that you're developing for. But if you have a 3DS, which isn't as powerful as the other machines, that overhead may eat up a very valuable chunk of its processing power, and therefore it may not be able to maximize the system. I mean, I'm not saying it won't, but that's that big challenge that Unity's and Nintendo is going to have to face, and how to maximize the 3DS through Unity. That's going to be very, very challenging. So yeah. I really hope they pull it off. It'd be fantastic. But we know firsthand making an FPS engine for the 3DS. We literally rewrote it to do Moon Chronicles. We had an engine that worked fine for face races and panic crashes and ATV and, I guess that was it. And that was a separate engine actually than our MUDS engine. Then we created a new engine, which actually now is doing Treasure Nauts and Moon Chronicles. It's one engine that's doing both, and it's very optimized to make sure that Moon Chronicles could run at 60 frames a second with 3D on. Which is not an easy thing to
Damn.
Do. Yeah, it's incredible. I would love to see Unity pull that off. It's going to be a big challenge. But anyway, regardless, I'm really hoping they pull it off because it'd be awesome. It'd be so flexible and we'd see so many more games on the platform, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're definitely getting to a point where you're seeing almost games coming to Vita willy-nilly, and I think a lot of that, it doesn't have to do with, like, oh, the Vita's flying off the shelves, but from what I've heard is that it's really easy to develop for Vita, so it's kind of like, if you're releasing it on another platform, it's like, it's not really that much of a pressure.
Yeah, I think to put it in perspective, and it is a lot of work, even to do another platform, but it isn't in ratio to what you just did. You know, you spend, you know, if you, from a project, and if it takes 100% to do, you know, for example, you know, PS3 and Vita, which obviously a lot of people are doing, 90% of it is PS3, and then the 10% to finish off the Vita kind of thing as far as the ratio. So it's not for free, but it's definitely worth it. You know, you get to spend that 10% and get a whole new platform.
Out of curiosity, when you brought MUDS over to PS3 and Vita, like which one was kind of like the lead, if there was one?
Probably Vita, honestly.
Cool.
Just, I mean, from a programming point of view, let me think now. I think we did Vita first, because we didn't know what to expect. And honestly, we were just more excited about it. I mean, we love handhelds, and the Vita has freaking ridiculously beautiful screen.
I mean, I was telling you at that Nintendo event, the Nintendo Indie event where I got to play Treasure Nauts and Moon Chronicles.
Right.
About how Mutant Muds on the Vita is probably my favorite version of the game because the screen's so damn beautiful.
I know. It's alien technology, man. I mean, the colors look more vivid than they ever could or should. It's absolutely amazing. I adore the way it looks on the Vita. I mean, if it had 3D, it'd be like, oh my gosh, it would be amazing. But, it is. It's beautiful. And it's slightly wider, view into the game as well. It's slightly more, that you can see on the screen, which is really nice. Yeah, I love it. It's a really nice version. Really enjoyed playing it on that. That actually reminds me that we're finishing very close to finishing up the deluxe update for the 3DS.
Oh, cool. So that'll add in all the ghost stages?
Yeah, the 20 ghost levels, all the hidden characters that are related to that, and the optional checkpoints. That you may or may not want to turn on.
Some of the levels.
Yes, some of them for sure. Those ghost levels are like freaking tough.
I mean, it's one of those things that like I'm like, oh, this is easy, but it's just because I've played through the game already.
Right. So that's exciting. So yeah, that's actually, weirdly enough, just a side story. We actually had to port MUDS to our new engine entirely for the ghost levels. So it wasn't like an easy, like, oh, press a button, compile it to 3DS now. Yay, done. Literally, Matthew Gambrell, huge brained programmer person, ported MUDs to our new engine to make sure, because we had so much crap going on in the ghost levels, lots of alpha transparency and crazy stuff, it just didn't run as fast as we wanted it to on the old engine. And the old engine was no slouch for the 2D stuff, for sure. But now it's much more optimized. So yeah, weirdly enough, we had to port the game to our new engine to make it work for the 3DS. So we're putting a lot of effort into this free update, but we feel, you know, the 3DS is MUD's home, you know, so we never want to shortchange it. So I was going to use the word obligation, but that sounds like it's negative. It's not. We don't feel like it's a drag or a chore, quite the opposite. It's definitely something we respect and want to make sure we do it right. So that's why we did it.
A labor of love, perhaps.
Definitely. Definitely. And it's nice, yeah.
So to get back to Cole County, I was reading the Kickstarter today, as many people were, and you described the game as sort of The Walking Dead meets something like Silent Hill, which has me very excited, because I love the sort of story-driven elements of Walking Dead, but I do sometimes miss having, like, complete control over the gameplay. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how Cole County, how you expect it to play, and what exactly is going on in the game.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to kind of expand on that kind of, you know, marketing sentence that we kind of created to try and explain the game in as few words as possible. The Walking Dead element is definitely obviously the episodic nature of the game, but also the to try and help suggest our extra focus and emphasis on character interaction. Whereas Dementium and Dementium 2 and Moon, I guess, to a lesser degree, but was more about you just walking around killing things. Moon isn't really that, but Dementium 1 and 2 kind of was. We're definitely focusing more on characters and having stories, not just, and that's where the Silent Hill 2 kind of thing comes in as well, when you meet characters and kind of have some meaningful conversations with them, not only on an informational level, but also on a creepy, like, I don't know if I trust you kind of level, or I do trust you level. Just, you know, characters actually add to the story. So that's what we're trying to say with some of that. And also with the kind of Walking Dead kind of reference. And actually, I would also kind of throw in there things like Lost and Heroes and shows like that, which Greg and I are big fans of. Trying to take from what we love about those kind of shows and the game, Walking Dead game, is just the way the story arcs, you know, not only happen within a single episode, but also connect from episode 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 and even 1 to 3 and so on. There's multiple arcs going on that as a player going through it, I think that'll be quite satisfying to kind of see those play out. And hopefully you'll have that sense of, I need to get to the next episode to resolve this sub quest or main quest or whatever is going on, or sub story, sorry, or main story. So that's kind of what we mean by that. And with the Silent Hill 2 stuff, what I love about that specifically, and I always call out Silent Hill 2 specifically because I just think it did such a good job with that game, is it's not scared to have moments of nothingness once the game has set up a credible threat, you know, because then you have tension, because then you have a feeling of, I don't know if something's about to happen, because something did happen before. So I'm not sure, you know, if I feel safe to go down there or whatever. And I think that's another important element that we're going to be focusing on. So it's not going to be nonstop, you know, character stuff or nonstop action combat stuff. It's definitely going to have some moments of walking through an area and that maybe there's nothing there or maybe there's something there. And that's the point, you don't know. And we'll probably go to the point to try and, so when we play it, you know, the people who are actually making the game, to try and make it so we can enjoy it, we'll probably actually create a somewhat of a random element to it. So maybe there's sometimes there will be something there, sometimes there won't. Maybe the numbers of what they are or even what they are may vary based on what's going on. Not that the whole game's going to be randomly generated, but just in small controlled ways. So the player, you know, who's even familiar with the game, still feels a bit uneasy because they're not quite sure what might happen. And I think that's really important.
There's a game, I played it on PS4 kind of recently called Outlast. Mm-hmm. It was a PlayStation Plus game that does a kind of randomly generated first person. Like there's a lot of stillness in that game. And then you find something that's scary and it will scare the shit out of you.
Oh, that's awesome. I need to check that out. Is it only PS4?
I think it's on PC as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it came out on PC like last year.
Oh, yeah, cool. I need to check that out. Nice.
And then Silent Hill Shattered Memories is another game, I mean, in that Silent Hill series. But, I mean, that was a game that very deliberately separated the combat from the kind of exploration.
Mm-hmm.
But the exploration had this palpable tension because, like, yeah. You know, things weren't right.
Yeah.
And you didn't know what was going on, so everything was just kind of on ease.
Yeah. And the story setup, I guess I skipped ahead of that, but the story setup is, the game is set in a small, dusty West Texas town. And when you, the reason you're going there is you try to contact your sister, because your mom, is deathly ill. You try to call her on the phone and she doesn't answer. So you drive across Texas for about 6 hours to get to this town. And it's a town that you're familiar with. The player character's familiar with, that, you know, as a kid, he visited there with his aunt and his sister. So he's kind of revisiting there. So there's a sense of familiarity for the player character. But this massive dust storm is kind of rolling in as you get there. And really it's about your journey through that town and kind of what you unearth over time. But when you first get there, you know, you can't find your sister. You talk to some of the locals, you find out information, and you kind of gather a sense of what the town's about and what's going on, and you start to form small kind of relationships with some of the people that you meet, and those, you know, relationships, you know, may slightly change over time, or people may, you know, go off for a while and then come back. And so I think there's going to be quite a lot of fun kind of interplay there, fun from a scary bad kind of perspective.
Yeah.
Not a comedy, not a romantic comedy perspective. So it should,
it's
be
like, oh, he's in love with that guy, yeah, with that gas, right, mask.
Yeah. So I think it's fun. There's a lot of different levels of thinking of. You know, I do tend to talk a lot about the story and that kind of stuff, I guess, because that's kind of more new, I suppose, when compared to, like, you know, Dominium and stuff. But it, you know, the enemies were definitely going to be a huge part of producing the fear as well, which is something we had a lot of fun with, specifically with Dominium 1, not so much with Dominium 2. I think that failed in some regards as far as the scare factor, but I think Dominium 1 actually was more successful. Yeah,
Dominium 1 was, I mean, even, I mean, and the DS with the smaller screen and stuff like that, like, that was still a game that I would play and be kind of like, oh, shit, what's going to happen next?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely.
And then seeing some of those monsters almost being abstracted from, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that it you know, wasn't, you know, a snazzy HD console. Like, I feel like that almost worked it more. It had a little bit mm-hmm. of grime.
Yeah. Yeah, we're definitely going for the grit as well on this. I mean, I like in the 3DS demo we had last year, we had that grit layer over the screen. And
yeah.
That just adds a lot. You know, we'll definitely continue with that kind of dirty kind of feeling. So, but yeah, that's some of the basic kind of information about the game. You know, from a weapon point of view, you know, the player's not going to be some Rambo character. You know, you're definitely going to be underpowered, and have to find your weapons and ammo sparingly, you know, throughout the journey. And I guess that's another key element to you feeling, vulnerable, and it not being just an action game of just mowing down, you know, countless zombies. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that's just not what this type of game is. You know, we want to try and scare people, and make them feel uneasy and fearful for, you know, their situation. So, it's exciting. It's a lot of fun to get back to thinking about this type of stuff, you know.
Related to the combat, you have a mock-up screenshot of kind of the player holding a wrench.
And
think you said melee combat's going to definitely be part of the combat.
Right.
Just looking at it, it kind of reminded me of Zombie U, and I guess I was wondering, did you play Zombie U, and was there any influence there as far as the melee combat and that kind of tension?
I haven't played it much. I definitely will be playing that as reference for sure. No, it has absolutely no influence on it, actually.
Okay.
I played it at PAX Prime when it first came out, a year or two ago, I guess it was now. Like two years ago, maybe?
Maybe it was the PAX before Wii U came out.
Yeah, probably.
2012.
I played it very briefly, and it was a really nice game. I like it a lot. And that was it. That's the only time I played it, was at the show, like for like 5 minutes, whatever they let me play before they kicked me off. So I haven't deeply kind of researched it, but I did like it. I like the polish of the game. They did a very good job. So I definitely will be looking at that, for reference. That's something I always do with all our games, is just look at all of the competition to kind of see what they did well and what didn't work
well. When you play Zombie U, you should come back and talk to us.
Yeah. yeah, for sure.
Because Scott carries a torch for that game.
I love Zombie U. Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
Awesome. No, I'd love to. Yeah, we'd never talk about it. I mean, for now, I think really our thought on the melee stuff is one of the big focuses is to try and generate that sense of closeness with the enemies. You know, that kind of that uneasy kind of like, I don't want to get close to them, but I have to. Yeah, mm-hmm. I have no choice but to get in their face to kill them, basically, which is nice. I like that you can't just stand from afar and just blast them away. Right. So that's one of the big reasons why we're going for melee, because to kind of force the player to kind of face that, which I think would be fun.
Sure.
But yeah, no, I'll definitely look at Zombie U and see what's going on there, for sure.
Yeah, I think it does a good job of like mixing melee combat with survival horror, so I think you'll enjoy that. Yeah, trying to bring that here to Cole County, I think you'll enjoy that.
I remember having a baseball bat, and that felt really good. No, sorry, yeah, cricket bat, sorry.
The cricket bat, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much awesome. Your main weapon throughout, yeah.
Yeah, okay, that felt really good, yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about sort of the tiers for the Kickstarter and kind of what your goals and things like that? And then I think we've got some listener questions we can ask you to.
Yeah, so our minimum goal is $580,000, which is an absolute a lot of money. which for you and I as individuals would be like, yay, rich, go and buy some cars. but for a team, it's actually still pretty slim, but we're pretty lean and pretty used to making not much money go a long way. So for us, it will allow our team to do a lot, which is exciting. So that's the minimum goal. And for that minimum goal, we have all of the, was it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 platforms that will be covered underneath that goal. So the pledge tiers with the minimum one, which is 5. Well, I guess the minimum technically is 1, but whatever. But the first reward is under the $5 one. And for that, you get a desktop wallpaper image and your name in the credits as a backer. So that's the minimum one. And then it goes up to 15 for the early adopters. And that's the first tier where you actually get the game, basically. You'll get, it's really a season pass. You'll get all 5 episodes of the first season, for that price. And then the next one after that is 20, which is the same reward, but it's for those that didn't jump in and get the early adopter, reward. Next one is 30. You get the digital soundtrack, download of the game, as well as a couple of bonus tracks
that will only come with that. Who's doing the music for this? I think it's on the Kickstarter page, but
Mr. Troop Gamage, who did
the
music.
That is wonderful news.
Yes, from Muds, which, you know, some might be like, "What? Is it going to be chip music?" And no, it's not.
Has he done like, you know, I guess music that would be more in line with this that you've used before?
Well, the music that you hear in the video is his music.
All right.
And the music on the Kickstarter page, if you scroll down to what about the game, and it talks about the game, there's a, you can actually press play and there's a piece
of
music.
I like that.
That is
a nice touch. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know what? Yeah. It worked on me. I kind of put it in there and I was like, all right, I'll press play. I'll read it like I'm reading it. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is really drawing me in. I like this. It's like, oh, that's really cool. So yeah, it works actually surprisingly well. I was like, all right, nice. Anyway, so yeah, the music has been done by Troop, and he's just a very talented person. I'm hoping people don't, well, obviously they have no choice but to pigeonhole him as a chip tune artist, but he's obviously way more talented than that. You know, it's not more talented than that. His talent goes beyond that, I should say. You know, he's in a band, you know, he's a singer, he's a guitar player. And obviously the Cult County music you can hear is very, different, than Mutant Muds. So, so there's, the $30, pledge tier for that. Next one is 40. You get the digital art book, which is 100-odd pages of, really lots of stuff. It's not just an art book, but I kind of named it that to kind of make it, simple to understand. So it will obviously have sketches and concept art and photos and character bios and so on, but it will also include, you know, behind the scenes stuff and, design notes and stuff like that. So it's more of a kind of just a, you know, a catalog of just the game development, really. And all of these all include all of the previous rewards as well. So if you get, you know, if you pay 40 for the digital art book, you also get the soundtrack and, you know, obviously the game and the desktop and so on. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, as far as with the rewards with the games, because it's going to be episodic, and I assume that the first deliverable date is just going to be the first episode.
That is to be determined. It really, depending on what goal is reached with this, can affect that. So it's I don't want to necessarily say one way or the other because it may change based on what funding it gets or doesn't get. It's possible that episode one could actually come before that date.
All right. Now, I mean, because that date is, it's May 2015, if I recall correctly. And
yes.
I mean, that's somewhat far away, more than a year.
Yes. Exactly.
And, I mean, just seeing a lot of Kickstarter games, like, I mean, as much as I completely understand how, like, Shovel Knight got delayed, for instance, but that was a game that was supposed to be out last September, I think, and it's still, I think it'll be out this month, but that's a significant delay. Is that kind of having it be farther out like that? Is that your way to kind of compensate for how a lot of Kickstarter projects seem to slip?
Well, really, it was under the thinking of, you know, it's a good, healthy kind of time to have, and whether that's one episode or multiple episodes that happen between that date, we're hoping that something will definitely be delivered by that date, and maybe more than maybe some people are even expecting. So hoping just to kind of not create disappointment through that, you know. If we said December this year, which, you know, or January next year or whatever, you know, for episode one, and say we, you know, can't quite meet that, then it's like, you know.
Yeah.
So we can get, the nice thing is it's a safety net for us to be like, yes, it could just be episode one, you know, May next year, or we could potentially, you know, release episode one, you know, this Christmas, for example. You know, maybe the episode two is in May of next year or whatever. So yes, in it would be a short way of answering your question. Yes, it is in reaction to that. So the next tier is the $60 tier, which is early access. And this is kind of where it starts to get into something that I'm pretty excited about with the Kickstarter, you know, just the whole Kickstarter thing, period, is just a way for players to, or backers to get involved, in the process of actually making the game, which is really cool. So this is really the first tier that really kind of gets into that. So it's early access. You can download the beta version of the game, through Steam, basically through Windows PC, to get your hands onto the game. And, those that are willing and interested can then start providing feedback, you know, on what they're seeing, what they like and what they don't like, and what breaks and what doesn't break, and so on. So that's cool. So that's like the first entry level of that. The next one is $80, which is getting, you know, into more of the physical rewards. The first, you know, so it's the first physical reward, which is the physical soundtrack CD, which is really essentially a physical version of the, you know, the digital soundtrack. But, you know, if we're hoping to have, you know, at least, you know, a unique track or two for that tier as well. Next one is 100, which is the contributor, where you get the alpha version of the game, access to that, be one of the elite, if you will. and it's a bit more detailed, where then you'll get access also to, more voting as far as, you know, giving your opinion on character designs and weapons and boss designs and even audio stuff. So those people will definitely have more access to kind of giving their opinion on elements of the game. Next one is 125, funnily called cosplay, I hope you pronounce that, where you get, to basically, you get a hat, so you can be Gavin Mellick from Cole County. You can wear a baseball hat and look just like him. I'll have a unique company logo emblazoned on the front. So you can go to PAX as Gavin Mellick, and everyone will recognize you and pat you on the back.
Or it'll just be you running around being like, hey, way to be, guy.
Yep.
Exactly. There's already six backers for it, so.
Yeah. It's fun, you know? It's cool, because it will be a unique. Yeah. It's not literally just a baseball hat. I mean, it is, but it'll have a unique, you know, logo on it, just like the character in the game. So it's fun. Actually, I'm pretty fond of that. It's funny and it's silly, but I kind of dig it. It's fun. The next one is 250. We get a signed game poster. You know, a 24x36 big old poster signed by the team, which would be lovely. Next one is 500, the hardcover book version of the digital one from before, also signed. And the next one is $1,000, which we do have one of, amazingly. Someone has backed that. an enemy designer, which is really getting into some dirty hand designery action here, which is really exciting, where it's limited to just five. And each of those backers will have their own enemy that they'll be working with us to design, not only from a visual perspective, but also from a gameplay perspective. So we will work with them to then determine a specific enemy. So pretty exciting. Honestly, I mean, if I, you know, was younger and I wasn't in the industry and I actually had some money somehow, I don't know, that's a really nice way to kind of get in there and you know, actually do something for a game and get a credit in the game, an enemy designer credit. It's cool.
I think if Kickstarter was around like 10 years ago, it would be very, very dangerous for me.
Like college loan money.
The next one is 2,500, which is pretty neat for those, you know, that actually want to be in the game. So you can put your face and your voice in the game and get a credit as a special appearance. And it could be anywhere from an enemy to a NPC character to a corpse or whatever. A variety of different opportunities for your mug to appear in the game. And you'll see, on the page, you'll see an example that Greg did of himself, which is quite humorous, him as the sheriff, which is pretty cool. So that's pretty good. And you get a credit for special appearance. So I guess almost like an acting role in a way. There's 10 of those. The next one is 5,000. For you plus one, get a special VIP access to the wrap party, which we'll be having when the game is finished, and a producer credit in the game. And you'll get to come to Austin, Texas and enjoy hors d'oeuvres and drinks and actually play the game. So that'll be exciting. The next one is a silly fun one, which is for $6,666.
I like this one.
The dollar sign of the beast.
Yes, exactly. Which is the Demented collection. You know what's weird is I literally only have six of these. But that's what's really weird. I mean, we limited it to six, which was poetically fun. But I'm like, oh my God, I actually only have six. That's really weird and kind of creepy. So I have Dementium 1 and 2, North America and Japanese of both, for each person who chooses to back this, and also comes with, we have the DS decals that you can actually personalize your DS with that were printed originally, I guess 7 years ago. They're like antique, as well as Bright Dawn Treatment Center brochures and postcards. And then also, at the end of the development of Dementium 1, I actually created a Shutterfly photo book, which is kind of like, you know, behind the scenes making of. It's like a 22-page color photo book. It's actually really, it's hardback and everything. It's really neat, actually.
That's
like
awesome.
A 10 by 10 kind of size. And it's really neat. I made it because it's the only way you could make those kind of things then. It cost like $70 to print it at the time. It was like ridiculous. But I was like, oh, whatever. It'd be awesome. So anyway, so the cool thing is I still have that. When I log into Shutterfly, it's still there. I can still reorder it. And I'm like, oh, that'd be awesome. Anyway, so we're going to throw that in there as well. So, it's kind of a nice little unique thing. Anyway, so that's that. And then the final one is $10,000, which is executive dinner, where you get to come to Austin, Texas. We will cover the flight from within the US and lodging for one night. And we will go out and eat and drink, and you'll get an executive producer credit in the game. And of course, come to the party. Is that even included in there? Well, it's assumed, I guess, because it includes previous rewards.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. So that's all the pledges. And it, you know, it's interesting. Creating, those pledge tiers was a really difficult, strange thing to do. It's hard to kind of come up with all those things and make them fun and, price them and all the rest of it. But anyway, so that's what they are. So obviously everyone should go for the ones that are in the thousands because they're the best. That'd be great. That would be great.
Yeah, so if we have any entrepreneur listeners out there with sitting on millions.
Smeet Bass, the guy who gave us like several thousand dollars when we did our telethon last year.
Yeah, him.
If he's out there,
that
come
person.
On, man.
Yeah.
Brother out.
I mean, just drop a couple of 10,000s for you and a friend. Join us for dinner. It'd be great.
Everyone wins.
All right. Well, let's get to some of the questions that we put a call out on Twitter a little bit before. One of them is, what control options will Colt County have?
And this is probably directed towards Wii U, right?
Yeah.
Specifically.
Although, if you have information about the other ones, I would be curious.
I mean, as far as if there's any, you know, twin analog, twin stick, whatever you call it, twin thumbpad, circle pad, device will definitely be supported. You know, obviously the gamepad has the two analog sticks, so we'll definitely have a setup like that without a doubt. And that'll be, you know, for all of the platforms, have that. So that'll be one of them for sure. Obviously for the Wii U, we'll absolutely support the Wiimote, of course, as an option. It won't be the default. I think the gamepad twin sticks would be the default control because it's right there, you know, and you've got it.
Yeah.
And everyone has a gamepad guaranteed. And it's, you know, it's intuitive. It's easy. It's simple. It's very casual. You definitely can get in there and play the game. But if you prefer Wiimote, which is understandable, then you'll be able to switch to that. No problem. But we like to support as many as we can. I think choice is important. So we'll do the Pro Controller. We'll do the whole shebang, you know, everything that makes sense. So I think we'll have a lot of options for the Wii U, and all of the devices really, because I think for us, control is very important. And we realize, especially from coming from, you know, the DS and 3DS, having made first person shooters on that, we realize that, you know, control is very important. I mean, some people just simply cannot play Dementium on the DS because of the control setup, and it's totally understandable. It's not very comfortable for some people.
Then that kind of goes. Someone else also asked about CirclePad Pro for Moon Chronicles, which I actually got to try.
Indeed, you know for a fact that it does that.
No,
yes,
that works very well. As a lefty, I'm looking forward to trying to find a way to buy a CirclePad Pro for my XL because Nintendo Store does not have them anymore.
No, they run out. Yeah.
But I have seen, for anyone that's also looking for a CirclePad Pro XL, you can go on Amazon and import one from Japan for cheaper than the cost of getting one from Nintendo directly.
Oh, well, that's amazing. That's awesome and strange. Hopefully Nintendo have sold out because of people are buying it in preparation for Moon Chronicles. That's my hope.
There you go.
That's my hope. But, you know, Moon Chronicles has a lot of control setups, a lot more than we had on the DS. I mean, the DS games, I think we literally had stylus, left and right-handed, and that's it. Where with this, you know, obviously we have that as well. We'll obviously have the circle pad Pro support, left and right-handed, and actually a combination of the two, because once you have the CirclePad Pro, it then changes the rules where, you know, when you're playing it without the CirclePad Pro, for example, you know, you have to shoot with the left trigger. If you're right-handed, you have to shoot with the left trigger.
Yeah.
Because you're moving with the left circle pad and you're aiming with the right stylus. But as soon as you add the CirclePad Pro, now you're like, oh, cool, I can move with my left, I can look with my right, if you're right-handed. Maybe now I want to shoot with my right instead of my left. You know, my right shoulder bar. Some people may want to do that. And I'm like, all right, cool. So we have that as well. So we actually have we have a lot of options in there. And then on top of that, which is another option, which is surprisingly good, actually, is without the CirclePad Pro, you use the left CirclePad to move and use the face buttons to aim, to look around. And then use the L to shoot or the R to as an action button. Actually, or reverse those two if you are so inclined. That actually works really well. I didn't think it would. I'm like, whatever, let's just put it in there anyway, just so it's there. I actually, like, when I'm just feeling kind of lazy, I'll use that. I'll buzz around using that if I can't be bothered. You know, because, you know, using the stylus does have some fatigue after a while. Yeah. It just hurts, you know?
Kid Icarus Uprising is one of my favorite games on the 3DS. It's exhausting to play.
It
sometimes.
Is. It's exhausting. Exactly. So I find, you know, because we're playing the game all the time while we're making it, so it's like, oh my gosh. So yes, I'll switch to the non-circle pad dual stick kind of whatever setup. It's pretty good. So because I was using that a lot, we actually finessed that quite a bit to make it feel good, and I think it feels really good. I like it a lot, and I like to reverse invert the y-axis, and it feels great. I really, really like it. So, I'm really, really excited about the control options on Moon Chronicles. But anyway, yes, and that will carry through to all of our games, especially first-person shooters, because the control is so personal and so delicate for anyone who plays that genre. They definitely have a way of playing it, and if that doesn't support it, then they can't play the game. And I totally understand that. You know, if it doesn't support the way they want to play it, then, I'm not going to play it. And I get it. I totally get it, you know, because you feel like your hand is tied behind your back if you don't have your control setup available. So, yeah.
So and then we also had someone ask about gamepad support on the Wii U for Colt County. So, like, I guess how would you use the gamepad in any kind of unique ways? I mean, I know you're doing it for Unity, so that means there's parity across everything.
Right.
But I assume you'll use the gamepad for something, right?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we haven't specifically got to designing that aspect of it yet, but I expect things such as, you know, obviously displaying a map, which is the standard boring answer, I know, but you know, and some inventory stuff, you know, potentially as well. But some standard things that... The only reason that we would use the gamepad is if it makes the player's life better or easier. You know, we wouldn't do it for the sake of it, because that... Way too many games do that. Nothing against Uncharted on the Vita, but the touch controls of that are ridiculous.
Yeah.
They're completely ridiculous. They don't make the game better. It's ridiculous. It's just there to show off, you know? And actually makes the game worse. It's like, no, it feels better without the touch controls.
Yeah, you're like, I don't want to make this stone etching again, for the love of God.
Yeah.
Let me go.
Yeah, well, just the jumping and the grabbing, and it's just silly. So, you know, so we'll design the game initially as a, you know, as a twin stick LR button kind of setup to make that work as best it can. And then when we bring that, you know, then when we focus then on the Wii U and go, okay, this is our core control. What do we want to do to make it different or better for this player with this device in front of them? And if something naturally jumps out, then we'll jump on it. But if it works as is, then we might not do anything with a touchscreen. So that's the way we'll approach it anyway, which I know is kind of a lame answer, but hopefully gives people in confidence, as we'll use it if we think there's a really good way to enhance the game, but we're not going to use it for the sake of it.
Cool. And then will you have a off TV play, or at least is that like a hopeful plan at this point?
I have no idea. because the game is streamed from the, it has to be streamed to the gamepad, obviously, which was fine with Muds because, you know, the,
Wii, not way, as twitchy.
Yeah, it's way powerful, you know, and the CPU processing to send that over to the gamepad was not as much of a drain as it might be on some other games. This game obviously is going to be way more higher fidelity than that. So I don't know. I would like, that would be awesome, right? To be able to play it on the gamepad. Oh, yeah. I would love to do that.
Yeah.
That'd be amazing. But I don't know if we'll be able to pull that off technically. But yeah, definitely a wish list item for sure. I would love that. I love off TV play. I love it.
Yeah.
So I would love to do that.
It's a revelation. And it even makes, I don't think it's as well implemented, but using the Vita to play PS4 games is also really neat.
I agree.
We have another question, and this is kind of, I guess, unrelated to the game specifically, but it's, one person saying that they'd love to know your thoughts on the current third party situation. I assume he means on Wii U and maybe to a lesser extent 3DS. Can you see why support for Wii U isn't really there?
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious. Unfortunately. You know, I love Nintendo and I say that all the time and I mean it. I really do. I love the company. I love the people who work there. I love the games they make and the hardware they make. I really appreciate everything they do and they're amazing at what they do, but they really messed up with the launch of the Wii U on multiple levels. And we don't have to go into that, but I think that was instrumental in, when you look at people, you know, publishers like Activision, or not necessarily them, because I don't know if they've pulled out or what they're supporting.
I think that Activision's one of the few companies that seems like they might still support it. I think, as far as I know with them, I think Skylanders is still doing alright on Wii U.
Yeah, good point. And Rayman. And that was Ubisoft, sorry.
But with Ubisoft, I think Rayman did it okay. I think that was the best platform for it, actually. But Assassin's Creed and Splinter Cell did terribly on Wii U.
Right.
To the point where, I mean, we saw it with Watch Dogs. That's not coming out at the same time as everything else. And in all honesty, I kind of call into question if we're going to see next year's Assassin's Creed out on Wii U, especially as the focus goes more to PS4 and Xbox One, because the Wii U can't hang with those dogs.
Yep. But yeah, no, it makes sense, unfortunately. I mean, it's a real shame. Nintendo didn't have a great launch with the Wii U for multiple reasons. And then, you know, publishers are all about numbers, you know, and if the hardware simply is not performing as well as they would like, then they're not going to put money there, not going to risk it, you know. It's really, unfortunately, as simple as that. But then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you create this cycle of no software, no hardware, blah, 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 you know, sales, and then it squarely falls back on Nintendo's kind of lap to then pick up the slack.
it is that chicken or the egg kind of argument, because like what came first, the crappy sales or the shitty support?
But you know, unfortunately, and I'll reiterate, I do love Nintendo, but it is their fault. Unfortunately, I mean, they really did mess up with the launch of the Wii U. And I had, you can go back in my Twitter history. I had absolute faith that they would pull it off. I was thinking they did a soft launch when they first launched it that year, whenever it was. And because there was really very little marketing, very little public awareness. It was like, kind of, let's just sneak this out there for the gamers. And then they had, you know, Zombie U, some really hardcore stuff kind of available, I think, at the time, if my memory serves me right.
Yeah, because, I mean, the launch, the game lineup wasn't that bad, because you had Zombie U, you had Mario U, Nintendo Land, I'll Still Stand By as a solid game. Like, there were fun games.
Well, we always talk about that here, we think it's probably the best launch of any of the three, like, newest consoles, because there was a lot there.
I agree.
From the start.
No, the software was there. Yeah.
The most important thing was that I think that Xbox One and PS4 have had better, first quarter of the next year.
Mm.
And that's even on the basis of the fact that, like, you know, they have Titanfall and Infamous, because that almost immediately trumps Lego City, which was like the game that came out on Wii U for 5 months.
Yeah. I think where they messed up was lack of marketing, lack of public awareness. You know, people just didn't know what it was. They had no, is this a peripheral to the Wii? Is this a new Wii U? Why do I want the Wii U? I mean, they just really dropped the ball, unfortunately. So the public didn't buy it. And then publisher said, oh, it's not selling, so I guess I'm not going to make games for it. And the rest is history. So it's a real bummer.
Yeah. I guess it does seem at this point that you're going to be kind of going more, platform agnostic to an extent. Is that done at all because of the poor Wii U or 3DS sales? Or is it just because you have the capacity with stuff like Unity to be able to release more games more places?
Or even the funding of Kickstarter, if that helps.
Yeah.
Right. Honestly, if we could make, I'm talking about me personally, I can't speak for everyone in the company, but me personally, if I could make 3DS games forever, I would. Simple as that. I would. I love it. I love the 3DS. I love making, I love working with limitations. I like working with limitations. It's fun. It's challenging. And if you actually pull off anything half decent, it's like, yay, that's awesome. you know, because it's hard, you know, and I like that. I like challenge. I like to do things that are difficult, and I love the 3DS. It's especially the XL. Man, I love the XL. It's a beautiful machine. So, you know, I would make games for that forever if I could. But no, financially, you know, we did some stuff, and Monster did, you know, really well on the eShop. But every other game we've released so far has not done even close as well as far as sales as Monster did, for various reasons, you know. I'm hoping Treasure Knots maybe, you know, gets a little bit closer to what Monster did because of what it is.
I hope that Treasure Knots looks awesome.
Thanks, man.
That's really all I can say at this point is from the moment, for the word go with that game, I'm like, all right, I'm listening.
Yeah, it's a fun one. I'm excited to get back to that and get that finished up. And then Moon Chronicles, I'm really, really pumped about, actually. It turned out really good, you know, and I know I'm completely biased. I mean, I'm a bit biased, I guess, but it did exceed my expectations. I was like, you know what, let's do when you ever think about, oh, we're doing a port of a DS game to 3DS, it's like, well, how good is that really going to look, you know? Unless you're really completely redoing it, but we knew we couldn't completely redo it because it had to run in 60 frames a second. Therefore, we can't maximize all of the visual goodness that the 3DS can do and maintain that with 3D on. However, you know, I don't know, we just chipped away at it, and you know, the guys are just really good at what they do. The programmers are very talented. The Greg, art director is very talented, you know, and I'm always pushing them to do maybe stuff that they don't want to do, but in the end it turns out pretty cool. I don't think I'm a tyrant, but I'm the geeky gamer that's like, hey, look at this. How cool is that? Can we do that? Can we do that? You know, until they're like, all right, we've done it. But no, I'm super proud. I mean, Moon Chronicles to me looks really good.
I'm really excited to finally play that because it was a game that, when I first heard about it, like, I, you know, kind of enjoyed the Dementium game, or I guess, yeah, it was only the first one at that point, and the idea of Moon seemed a lot more appealing to me, and then I just could never find it anywhere. So then I just kind of forgot about it. Now I'm like, all right, cool, it's coming out on eShop, I can just download it.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I mean, it's going to be a certain unique challenge as far as the episodic release and pricing it and awareness and can we do season pass and do people even care about that and blah, blah, blah. So we have a few hurdles to jump over, and Nintendo's excited to to figure out those challenges with us, which is a great honor as well to be, you know, chatting with them about that kind of stuff. So I said, we'll figure it out, you know, and there's going to be some creases to iron out with that, I'm sure, because it's so brand new in that regard. But hopefully it'll help, you know, make it a little bit easier for Cook County when that gets finished up. But yeah, I'm really excited about that. I think it's going to be really cool. And I can't believe that we'll be the first FPS on the machine. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And now I know, what is it, Hugo Smith's the guy from Goodbye Galaxy who did Tap Bingo. He's working on a 3DS first-person shooter, which is it's great. Only it totally took 3 years for them to be first-person shooters on the 3DS.
I'm, you know, for completely self-serving, selfish reasons, I'm hoping, I mean, does really well. But beyond that, if it does prove that that is a valid genre for that market, then that's really exciting. I mean, I would love, there's a lot of stuff I'd love to do within that genre on the 3DS. And that did play into our decision to bring Cook County away from the 3DS, because we're already gambling there in our minds with Moon Chronicles. We have no idea how well that's going to do, because we literally have no data to base it on. So it's like, it could be, you know, a complete failure, could do medium okay, could do awesome. No idea. Yeah. Could do any of those three. I think it'll do at least do medium, I hope, because I think it's a great game, and I think the gamers are there who want it, but I have no idea. And so for us, it's kind of like, well, do we want to do a second one of the exact same type of thing on a market that we have no clue if anyone wants it, you know? So that
I
was,
hope they do.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. Anyway, so. Yeah,
I guess let's wrap this up, because I think we overshot what we estimated.
We were like, yeah, just a little 20-minute segment.
Yeah, like something like that. But I want to end this on kind of, as you probably know at this point, by the fact that I brought a box copy of South Park Chef's Love Shack to PAX East last year.
Oh my gosh.
I'm minorly obsessed with your back catalog of what you worked on. So let's talk about Iggy's Wrecking Balls.
I love that game.
Yep. Really? That's amazing. Oh,
that was, we tweeted a little bit about it before, like months ago, but that was like a staple of like my rental history when I was like in middle school or something. I rented that game all the time and really enjoyed it.
That's amazing. That's
probably
so
better
cool.
I bought it, I guess. I don't know how like that, how, what kind of money you make from rentals. Maybe I should have bought it and had my mom buy it as a birthday present sometime. But
I think the way it worked then is like Best Buy or Blockbuster would like buy, you know, 5-10,000 units, and then say, you know, we would get that, you know, from it, but no rental money. But that was all a claim money anyway, so I didn't get any of that.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
didn't affect me.
so screw them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, screw the man. You know, that project is definitely got a special place in both me and Greg's heart, because Greg was the lead artist on that game.
Yeah.
Who's the art director of Renegade Kid.
And was that the first game that you were the lead on too?
It was my first project manager position. Ah, right. So I'd been lead artist before that on Zero the Kamikaze Squirrel for the SNES, which was in a weird offshoot of Aero. And so this was the first project where I was project manager. And what that position was, even though it doesn't sound it by that description, it was a lead designer and producer in one role, which is an absolutely terrible idea, but we were giving it a shot at the time.
Well, I mean, as someone who routinely finds himself on Moby Games looking at game credits, some of the ones from like the 80s and 90s are just so, it's nonsense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like,
no,
none of them make any sense. Yeah, and you're totally. Like, what did this person actually do on this game?
What
did
does
he
that
do
mean?
Everything or nothing?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. So that was, you know, it's a funny process, because we had this weird little corner of the floor that we're on at Iguana, Acclaim, whatever it was called at the time. We actually had this weird fire door that we could close, and we put this massive kind of top secret sign in the front and stuff. And it was fun. It was like a team of 12 people kind of tucked away. And I'm trying to think, originally we were doing Turok 1.5, which we were going to call Turok 2. While the Turok team were making the actual Turok 2. So whatever that would have been named. So we were making that, and it was a fun project. It was so cool to take all the Turok assets, and we kind of set it in a nice kind of cool, icy kind of, place. We had these awesome colored kind of ice versions of the Velociraptors. Oh, that's so cool. I mean, this like really awesome kind of
Is that where the ideas for Fehendrana Drifts from Metroid Prime came from? Because I know that Iguana people
oh, I don't
went
know.
Over to, went over I'm to Retro sure. Studios.
Probably not. I think that would be awesome if so. I doubt it. But maybe, I have no idea. But it was really, really neat. We were working on that for a while, but then that got canned. Not sure exactly why, actually, in the end, but.
Yeah, because didn't the first Turok sell really, really well?
Oh, yeah, no, it sold really well. But no, the Turok team continued making Turok 2, but they just stopped making 1.5. And they said, but you can do an original game instead. Like, oh, cool. So we kind of come up with, you know, a bunch of different concepts. You know, one was obviously Iggy's. One was like this kind of space shootery, almost like Star Fox type thing. What was the other one? I don't know. There was a third one. I can't remember what it was. All really different from each other. The idea was we wanted to have a multiplayer fun component to it. I think was the main kind of MO. And weirdly enough, the Iggy's one was my idea because I wanted to do a 2D platform game, but I knew we couldn't get away with doing 2D in the era because it was all about polygons at that time. So I was like, well, fine, I'll do 2D gameplay in a 3D world. How about that then? and then we'll make it like a Mario Kart. We'll make it like a four-player racing game because that makes sense, right? Sure, why not?
It's like Uni Racers.
Yeah. And so they went with that, and that was really cool. And it started off with this really amazing prototype that we created really quickly, to kind of prove the gameplay and just kind of went for it. And, the amazing thing about that project is it fit on a 4 megabyte cartridge, which is a really, that was really the smallest cartridge you could even get at that time, where most games were 16 meg and stuff like, 8 meg. So it was actually quite a technical marvel. The programmers did an amazing job there, but, we just had that. Bashed out all the weird little characters. Wasn't even called Iggy's Wrecking Balls at first. I think it was like Charlie's Wrecking Balls or something. Like I think there's a blue guy in, I don't know if he still made it in the game, but there's a blue guy with a little red nose. I don't know if he made it in the game or not. I can't remember now. I think he did though. Maybe not. He was the main character. He was completely un-main character like worthy. He was just very generic. But then we were like, hey, let's make it like a mascot game. That'd be really cool. And put Iggy in there. The rest is history. So, yeah, it was fun. It was fun. One of the things that it was funny at the time, we wanted to do, we had these really cool ideas to do a fun ad campaign where we'd do print ads in magazines because that's if people would buy magazines at that time, of people racking their balls, you know, like, so if you're walking along a fence and you slipped and then slammed your balls into the fence, like moments, that moment of smack, we'd have these shots of people racking their balls, basically. Like doing ads. And we thought that'd be really funny, you know, kind of doing like a sepia tone or demult, you know, kind of nice, kind of black and white, but kind of color tone, you know, so the kind of a funny, cheeky kind of campaign of people hurting their balls and Iggy's Wrecking Balls. Be kind of funny. Perfect, right? Genius. But Acclaim wasn't having it because they just came off the backlash of the terribly sexist and meaningless ad campaign for Forsaken. Do you remember that?
Oh, God.
Where it just had a naked girl with tattoos on, basically.
Yep. Yeah.
They just came off of that. And they're like, nope, we're only doing ads that literally talk about the game, nothing else. We're like,
funny. That is like the very end of kind of that Play Loud generation. Yeah. Where like even Nintendo themselves were just having these like kind of gross out ads that didn't really tell you anything about the games.
Yeah. Shock factor. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It was like, So they didn't go for that, but we thought that was hilarious. I think that was hilarious.
That was pretty much a claim throughout their entire life. Cause remember, I think it was near the end where they had the, name your kid Turok.
Oh my gosh. Ridiculous. Yeah. Absurd. Yeah. Yes. So Iggy's. Well, that's really cool that you enjoyed it, man. I appreciate that. That's cool. Yeah, it had a racing mode, it has the battle mode. That was really fun making that game. It's good stuff.
Yeah, we've kind of talked about doing kind of like a revisit where we would play it now and do a segment about it.
Yeah,
and talk
actually,
about it.
I actually did win it off of eBay like a month ago.
Oh wow, nice one.
Just because I was curious and we had brought this up, so I figured
such
I would.
Because
I remember renting it, but I don't remember much else other than the fact that I played it.
Yeah, really strange game. Fun stuff, though.
Well, there you go. From the new to the old on this segment of Connectivity. It's good.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, that's fun.
Thanks a lot for sticking with us for the entire hour. And I will see you in about a week, sir.
Yeah, man. See you in Boston. Exciting.
Yeah, that's a good point. For anyone listening, if you'll be at PAX East, Jules will be there. Neil will be there.
Yeah.
So say hi to everybody.
Yeah,
the Renegade Kid booth is basically the de facto Nintendo booth.
Pretty
I
much.
Think.
Yeah, we'll have 8... 3DS unit set up with our games for people to play. So we'll have, you know, Muds, ATV, Bomb Monkey, and then of course, Moon Chronicles and Treasure Knots, for people to check out.
Yeah. And it's actually, aren't you using the, like, Nintendo tower things that they usually have at trade shows anyway?
Actually, no, we've rigged up our own room table. Cool. It's a little bit more lounge-like. So we have these small, cool little leathery kind of little cube things that you sit on. Probably not real leather, though. And these more coffee table kind of height tables. There's four little stools around each table. There's two tables with four 3DSs on each thing. So it'd be pretty chill. We're going to sit down and chill and play some 3DX action. And, yeah, it'd be nice.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely be hanging out. I'll be loitering around
excellent,
there.
Excellent, excellent. It'll be fun. Looking forward to it.
Being like, when's Treasure Notes coming out, huh?
Yeah, when's it going to come out?
Are you going to have anything for Colt County in your booth, or...?
Probably not. I mean, we'll have the banner, of course, showing off. And we'll probably have the Kickstarter video playing on repeat. So that'll probably drive us insane, on a TV.
By the end of it, Greg will actually be like he is.
Yes.
Yeah, he will literally be crazy.
Oh my gosh. He might actually bring, the costume that he wore.
Yes.
He owns that. He bought that. He owns that. That was his. You can ask him about that.
I'm now picturing where it's just like, oh, we gotta do this video. He's like, well, I got this mask.
Well, I've got this mask.
Everyone slowly backs away and it's like, where'd you get that? Why do you have this?
Yeah, it's such a creepy mask as well, because the way the rubber kind of, even the sound, we didn't quite get the sound in the video, I wish we had actually, but the sound is really disturbing. The rubber sound of him going, putting it on is like, whoa. It's really cool. It's really disturbing.
He should bring the mask.
I'm hoping he does the whole thing. Comes out, maybe not with the axe. That might get him in trouble. Yeah. But it's his axe as well. You can ask him about all of this stuff. They technically were not props. They were of his ownership. So, but no, it was a lot of fun making that video. And actually, I should send out props to Mark Zamora from Develop TV. He was, they're the film crew, the production crew, that helped us make that video and did a ridiculously good job.
Awesome.
And they found the location and everything. They did an amazing job. So, and they'll be doing that. Oh, and that's another thing I forgot to mention. There's a stretch goal, to do a documentary of the development of Colt County as part of the campaign.
That'd be super cool.
Yeah. So that's, something I've always been really intrigued by and wanted to be a part of, because I think it's just interesting. I like the behind the scenes stuff. So, anyway, yeah. So there you go.
Right. Yeah, and that's it. Cool. So, Colt County, go get on Kickstarter and give Jules your money.
Please.
So that way he can make this crazy-ass game, and then we can all play it.
There you go.
Thank you.
Awesome. All right, we'll talk to you guys later.
Cheers.
Bye.
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 Hey everybody, Alex Kalafa here, and today I'm going to be talking about the upcoming Super Smash Bros. For Wii U and 3DS Nintendo Direct, coming next Tuesday, April 8th, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and some equivalent all around the world. You can find that out yourself. Presumably on our website, NintendoWorldReport.com. The original purpose of this mini-segment, which should only be around 2-3-5 minutes, was to talk about what I think of Mario Kart 8, which was honestly, if you've heard me on this podcast before, probably not going to be too positive. If I did record that segment, I might say how bland it looks, I might say how uninspired it looks, I might say how I do not want to buy this game at all and will not. However, I'm going to be positive. I won't talk about how bland I think Mario Kart 8 is, because I want to talk about what I think is going to be on next Tuesday's Super Smash Bros. Nintendo Direct. I have a few things laid out here, and be sure to list off in the comments what you think is going to happen on this Nintendo Direct if you happen to listen to this show within 2 days of posting. I'm sure we're going to have something to say about this Direct in the following episode. So, first off, I want to talk about the length, because that is one of the biggest concerns leading up to any Nintendo Direct. How long is this thing going to be? The Wonderful 101 was about 20 minutes, I think, and that does not sound too crazy. I do not think this is going to be 40 minutes, 50 minutes, an hour. Simply put, because the game isn't that expansive. And that's not to say it's going to be a bad game. That's not to say it's not going to be a great game. Smash Bros. Games, traditionally, short of maybe Super Smash Bros. Brawl, which was obviously much bigger, they are not the hugest games in scope. You're going to get an adventure mode, probably going to be slightly bigger than Melee in this time around. You're going to get target shit. You're going to get board the platforms, maybe. Something with a sandbag, a bunch of trials. It's going to be a Smash Brothers game. It's probably going to be in between scale between Melee and Brawl. And because of that, I don't think there's 50 minutes of stuff to show without spoiling a little too much. So I think somewhere between the 8-minute Pokemon Direct and the 20-minute Wonderful 101 Direct, I think that sounds just about right, because that gives enough room for a little general discussion on the beginning and end that doesn't really tell us anything. Maybe a character reveal, maybe a few game modes, which I think is going to be the focus of this, and maybe a few other things in between. Next up, the name of this game. I think this might be the time when the name of this game finally gets revealed. And that includes the possibility that the name of this game has already been revealed. Maybe it is already named Super Smash Bros. For Wii U and Super Smash Bros. For Nintendo 3DS. I think that if the name is not changed by now, and especially if the name is not changed by E3, these games are called Super Smash Bros. For Wii U and Super Smash Bros. For Nintendo 3DS. However, if they do make a title announcement here, or even at E3, I think Super Smash Bros. Rumble, Super Smash Bros. Royale, those might be a couple of good titles. I do think there's a good chance that the 3DS and Wii U versions are going to get two different subtitles if the title situation does indeed happen to be the case. I just don't know what they're going to do with these names, because Super Smash Bros. For Wii U and Super Smash Bros. For 3DS is already very distinctive titles. It says exactly what you want them to say, even if they aren't totally exciting. But maybe they will go for the exciting factor. Maybe they will have something to follow up Melee and Brawl. And I do think that there's a decent chance it's going to be called a Royale, but don't quote me on that. I think Royale is probably that one out of all the kerfuffles, the rumbles of the world. Royale seems to just work the best in this situation. But maybe that's just me. The release date. I do not think they're going to pull an Amazon and put this out in April. With Sakurai's hand problems, with the fact that they're trying to get this game out as fast as possible, and considering I think they're still figuring stuff out, I think November is still probably the case for at least the Wii U version. Maybe the 3DS version ends up getting pushed into next year some, but I do think it's probably going to be like October for Wii U and Nintendo for November for 3DS, or November for Wii U and February for 3DS, or November for both. I don't think we're going to get this before, we're definitely not going to get this before E3, because they need an E3 to blow this game out. But I don't think we're going to get it too soon after either. I think, regardless of whether a release date is announced, and I don't think it will, unless they get a little ballsy like the Pokemon Direct and announce a release month, which I think is the case, this is still probably coming at fall at the earliest, assuming it doesn't pull a Smash Brothers and get delayed, which I don't think they have the option of doing at this point. Characters. I think this is the Nintendo Direct to announce Miis as playable characters, because I think the type of character who would be revealed during this Direct, probably a Mii, maybe a Pac-Man. There's probably still going to be a Yoshi, a veteran or two in there. I think two characters assuming this thing ends up being 20 minutes, sounds about right. If it ends up being 10 minutes, probably one really, really interesting character. But considering the fact that there have already been 24 characters announced, and there's probably going to be close to 40, I don't think they're going to stuff 50 in by the time this game comes out, considering how fast they're trying to push it out the door. I don't think they're going to do a huge character blowout right now, and I don't think they're going to do it closer to launch. I really think, and especially hope, that they keep at least 10 of the characters, you know, tucked in their hand away a little. Because there's got to be surprises. If you pull a Mario 3D World and you give away a lot of the surprises, a lot of people are going to justifiably get pissed off. Next up is the game modes. I think they are going to focus on game modes a little in this direct. I think they are going to focus a little bit on the adventure mode. I think they're going to focus a little bit on the side modes. I think there would not be a Nintendo Direct for this game unless there was something about the game, like the online possibly, that needs its own focus. There has to be a special reason Sakurai is setting up this specific Direct. And I think the meat and potatoes at the in this is going to be something surrounding game modes, probably the adventure or probably the online, because everyone knows the online is what we all care about in a Smash Brothers game, obviously. My final concern, and I kind of just told you what my final concern is, I hope they don't give away too much. I hope they don't pull a Super Mario 3D World and spoil massive chunks of the game with no reason other than the hope that people are going to get excited, even though I have a feeling a lot more people got pissed off. I want them to still have secrets under their cap that stay under their cap until this game is 2 weeks before coming out and someone spoils it anyways. I even though this is probably going to be a little bit more of a back-to-basics Super Smash Bros. Game, I want them to still treat it like a proper huge experience. I want it to be a proper huge experience, and I want them to hide stuff that I'm going to put the disc in my system day one, assuming no one spoils it for me, and I am going to go, hey, I did not see that coming. I did not see that coming at the end of the adventure mode. I did not see that coming in the character select screen, something like that. So that is what I want from this Direct, and I've probably given a little bit onto what I actually want from this game in general. If you listen to the show and it's before the Super Smash Bros. Direct, again, feel free to list off in the comments. If you have any Super Smash Bros. Related questions, be sure to send them to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com, and worst case scenario, I am going to try to scrap something together to talk about what does get revealed in the Direct sometime next week. So you can probably look forward to that, and you can look forward to all of the great coverage on NintendoWorldReport.com. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this segment of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson. I am with Neil Ronahan.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Who just started his new job today, so congratulations, Neil.
Yay!
We're all very proud of you.
Yeah.
Bringing home the bacon.
And now I gotta record some fucking podcasts.
Yeah. Living that adult life.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how my parents always described it to me, is like, just wait, like someday you'll graduate college and get a job and then come home from that job and just podcast all night. And I said, what are you talking about?
Just podcasting. And you're like, what's a podcast? And they're like, we don't know either.
Yeah. We've been drinking. That's a whole nother issue. Today we are going to be talking about Pokemon Battle Troze. Both Neil and I have been playing it over the past couple weeks, and both of us have written reviews for it. And we actually gave it the same score, 7 out of 10.
Yeah, I did have a 7.5, and I wound up, I don't know if I just had a change of heart, or it was a 7.5, and I think someone talked me down to a 7.
Oh, really? That's pretty good. So for those who don't know, Pokemon Battle Troze, which I hate saying that whole name, just came out on the eShop a couple weeks ago. You can purchase it for $8, and it is ostensibly a match 3 puzzle game, featuring Pokemon. It has, like, literally nothing to do with the original, Pokemon Troze on the DS. Like, nothing. I don't know that they could be any further apart. But yeah, it's kind of a cute little puzzle game, and I think what makes it unique compared to other Pokemon puzzle games, you know, like Puzzle League and stuff like that, is that it feels to me the most like an actual Pokemon game.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where it works.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of Puzzle Quest for the DS, and then like a million other platforms after that, where you're matching Pokemon faces, but what you're matching actually like kind of influences how the battles take place with the wild Pokemon you're puzzling against. So, you know, if you match 3 Charmanders, you do a fire attack. If you match, you know, 3 Squirtles or whatever, you'll do a water attack and so on. And then you use that to do super effective damage against the Pokemon you're fighting against, or not very effective damage if you do it incorrectly, which is the worst.
Yeah, that's like it's the biggest cock block ever.
Where it's like you string together a huge combo and then you realize, oh fuck, like I did rock against whatever flying or something and so it does nothing. Yeah, that kind of sucks. But what kind of makes this game also unique is that whereas like other puzzle games, you're kind of thinking 3 moves ahead and you're trying to string together, you know, like 3 or 4 combos and just eliminate some pieces. Troze has this chance mode where basically once you match 4 pieces, and then you match another 3.
Yeah, or it can even do, like, if you have a chain of 3, you just need to, like, do a 4 and a 3 at any point.
Yeah.
And that's basically what you do on every stage in the game. And that's where I begin to have problems, kind of.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that it's, like, I have fun with that, but I feel like it kind of very simplifies the idea of puzzle game into making it more of a Twitch-based game.
Right, and you basically have to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if there's any way you can survive, like, past, like, the first few levels just doing simple, like, 3 matches. Yeah.
And granted, you know, that's how a lot of other puzzle games work as well, but a lot of other puzzle games aren't as twitchy as Pokemon Battle Troze is, because you have to do everything so goddamn fast. Because you have to start the Troze chance, and then you need to, you need to get to, and you don't have all this time, because if you let it go too long, then it's gonna get stopped, and then it has a second thing, oh shit, you need to get a 4 and a 3 so you can start it over again and try to clear a second board.
Keep going and
that's the game. And that bugged me a lot, because it would be like, if I would fuck that up once, then I'm basically done for. I had, I think it was Sarek, I'll call him out, cause he called me out. In my review, I didn't mention, as much of the idea of the wall mechanic and the health mechanic.
Yeah.
Basically you have health. The other Pokemon that you're trying to capture, he's attacking you. And then that Pokemon can also break down the walls and come into the playing field, which is really obnoxious and makes it harder to match stuff. No, the reason why I don't really think those are that big of a deal is because all that does is impede your ability to go do Troze Chance. And you can, with certain Pokemon, like Mr. Mime repairs the walls, Chansey repairs health. All you're doing are using those Pokemon like you would be using, like, a super effective type. Like, it doesn't change the gameplay at all. It just gives you another thing to be mindful of, which I don't really think improves the experience.
Well, I found, too, that like, when I first got Chansey, I tried to keep Chansey in my party, which that's something we should mention, too, for people who haven't played the game. As you get further and further in the game, you get to bring Pokemon that you've captured throughout the game with you. So you kind of, like, get to kind of stack the deck in your favor. So if you're heading to a level that, you know, is dominated by grass Pokemon, well, you can bring along, like, 3 fire Pokemon, so you pretty much always have fire Pokemon in the map, which is cool. That's a cool mechanic.
And they dole it out where you start off where you can't have any support Pokemon, and then you can bring 1, and then 2, and then 3.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's a really cool mechanic. But then you can also bring along, like Neil said, a Mr. Mime or a Chansey. Chansey heals you, Mr. Mime repairs the walls. But I found that, like, it never did enough to really impact the battle. So, like, I tried to bring Chansey with, for a good portion of the game, and I would heal. But it was never, like, substantial enough. It was never enough where I was like, okay, now I can win this battle. if I was already weak, I was going to lose anyway. Yeah. Once I got to like the final Pokemon of a level. So it to me never really made a big difference. So I agreed with you. Like in my review, I didn't really mention much of that either because
it doesn't really make a difference. Yeah.
Right. I didn't find it really like a compelling part of the gameplay. Like in theory, it's cool, but in practicality, I never used it. It just did nothing for me.
I mean, like I like the idea of Pokemon Paddle Jose a whole lot. I think it is, you know, it's the rare thing where it's not a puzzle game with a Pokemon shell. Like it is a Pokemon game that's made to be a puzzle game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes it interesting, but I don't think it's amazing. I don't think it's that great. It's got issues.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I did really like the multiplayer. I don't know, did you ever get a chance to really play any of it?
I didn't really have the opportunity to. Is it download play?
No, unfortunately. Yeah. You'd have to, like Lauren would have had to have bought it too. Well, you guys just have one 3DS, right? So that wouldn't have worked
anyway. There's no way for me to do this.
Yeah, and it's local only, which is kind of unfortunate. But it's a lot of fun. I expected it to be kind of a competitive version of the game where you're playing against each other, but in actuality, up to four people are playing together, trying to beat Pokemon together. I don't think it scales the difficulty at all, so I imagine if you've got four people going at once, it's probably a breeze to get through the game. I don't think it scaled at all, but I don't know for, 100%. But my wife and I had a pretty good time because she loves puzzle games. Like, she's always playing, Candy Crush and a million other, basically, clones of that on her iPhone. So we had a really good time spending the whole weekend, like, playing together and capturing Pokemon and doing all that. I mean, you basically play through the whole game's, like, campaign mode.
Yeah, it's kind of neat.
Just cooperatively, which is cool. Yeah. So we had a fun time doing that, and it made it a little bit more enjoyable for me. Because like you said, it does get a little monotonous. I mean, really, the only thing to do are the Troze chances. Which, so instead of feeling like a cool reward for getting, like, good combos, it really is a necessity. I mean, you have to do it. Yep. There's no way you'll beat the game without doing it.
Yeah.
So, and they're not especially hard to do, because Pokemon Battle Troze, after you, like, match your first, three or four Pokemon phases, there's kind of this delay where you have a few seconds to then move more pieces and start to string combos together that way.
It's a very active puzzle game.
Yeah. It's not like a normal puzzle game where everything has to pretty much immediately fall into place. You've got this kind of buffer period where after you make a match, you can make more matches. And the whole game is really built around that and using the Troze chances and just stringing together the biggest combos you can. And, it's a little monotonous. I would agree with that. But it was definitely fun with two people. I enjoyed that. So, did you mess around, with the Safari Zone or anything like that? Like,
yeah,
going back every day?
A little bit. I mean, yeah, you can get different Pokemon by coming back every day.
Right, cool. The Safari Zone kind of refreshes and has different Pokemon types every day. You do eventually unlock, an endless mode where you can just try to survive as long as you can. Things like that. I don't really know what else to say about it. We both gave it sevens. I think it's a good puzzle game. I like that it uses the Pokemon license so well and really feels like a Pokemon game, but I probably still like something like Puzzle League better because I think it's a better puzzle game. You know what I mean? I mean, is that kind of where you fall?
I totally agree with that.
Yeah, so it's like I really enjoyed the use of the license, but as far as like just strictly a puzzle game, I mean, I think I like Puzzle League more. But I think there's enough here, especially if you're a big Pokemon fan, because that was another issue for me, is that you're matching these Pokemon faces, but you really don't know what they do until you match them, unless you're already familiar with every generation of Pokemon, because it pulls Pokemon from literally every generation. So I was good with the classics. You give me a Machamp, I know what a Machamp is, but with all these kind of other pretty much third to fifth or sixth generation,
fucking gens they're at this point.
Yeah, no kidding. I had a hard time with that. So there was a lot of experimentation. Okay, this Pokemon is fairy. I don't know what the fuck's good against fairy, so I'm gonna match all these Pokemon faces here until I find something that works.
Because usually the Pokemon that they give you, one of them's strong against what you primarily face. So why not? Let's give it a shot.
Yeah, so you just kind of match everything there until you find what works. And then just kind of use that. So, if you're a huge Pokemon fan, you've played every generation of game, you know these, just by seeing these Pokemon faces, you know exactly what type they are and what they're effective against. I think you'll enjoy the game a little bit more.
Yeah.
than I did, where I was just like kind of having to guess and saying, okay, I'll try this like weird brown guy with a spike on his head or something, you know, because I just don't, I'm not familiar with all of these.
Oh, you mean that guy? Yeah, everyone knows that guy. What are you talking about?
Poser.
Yeah. You're not a real Nintendo fan, man.
there was some of that in the comments of my review. So I think we both got called out on this one a little bit.
But I complained about. Damn it.
Yep. Same here. So I think that's it for Pokemon Battle Troze. It's a fun little $8 puzzle game on the eShop. If you are a Pokemon fan and a puzzle fan, I think it is worth playing. It is not a bad game. I feel like it could have been better with just a few little tweaks, but I did enjoy it.
And I guess, as a kind of little bonus to this, we're going to have a bigger segment on everything that we saw at a recent New York event, but because it was all crazy embargoed and there's still more stuff that's embargoed for next week. But the embargo for Mario Kart 8 will be up, by the time this is live. You'll be able to see my impressions, some news, and, probably my least favorite thing about playing Mario Kart 8, which is how the gamepad's fucking dumb.
Oh, really?
I had an editorial that the headline was toned down. The first draft was, the implementation of the gamepad in Mario Kart 8 is dumb. because, you know how it was like there was at E3, it was like the horn on the gamepad and you could honk the horn?
Well, and then during the investors meeting, didn't like Iwata specifically say like Mario Kart 8, they were going to start with that to start kind of building the gamepad up and utilizing it more.
If that's it, they should just throw in the fucking goddamn towel now. because what the gamepad is, at least as far as we know, you know, a month and a half out of the game launch, you can honk the horn, you can do the motion controls still, which aren't fun. I think there's actually video of me starting to try to do the motion controls and then stopping a little bit in after doing terrible. In general, anytime you see me in a video of Mario Kart 8, from that event last week, not my best Mario Karting. It's doing pretty shitty. But that was also because I was just like, oh, look at this item. Oh, I wonder what's over here. Oh, crap, I ran into a wall. But, so you have a map. So pretty much like the DS/3DS second screen. Mm-hmm. And you have a mirror of the TV. That doesn't mean, like, say you're playing two-player, and there's one person playing on the TV and the other person playing on the gamepad. No. You can't do that. That is not something you can do in Mario Kart 8.
Really?
Yeah. So, like, if we were playing split-screen, and I wanted to be like, oh, I'm just gonna play on the gamepad while you play on the TV, I'd be looking at a fucking split-screen.
Oh, my God. That is really bad.
Yeah, no five-player, no nothing. And I think, I mean, the game does look gorgeous. It's still Mario Kart. It still will be a ton of fun with four people. It's just that there is no point in using the gamepad for that game at all outside of single-player off-TV play. That is it.
That's unfortunate, because, like, that's something I'm for sure going to play with my wife. And if we could play online together with one of us looking at the gamepad and one of us looking at the TV full screen.
The two of you will still be able to play online together.
Right, just but in split screen. Yeah. I mean,
still don't know a lot about Mario Kart 8's online, but it seems like it's going to be like Mario Kart Wii's.
Yeah. Wow. Well, there you go. So all of your impressions and everything will be up this week then. So by the time this podcast is live, you can check that out. And probably watch some funny videos of Neil, which is always an enjoyable time. This is pretty good to tie it back to Pokemon. I mean, this is like playing Pokemon and then finding a shiny Pokemon. I mean, when you come in for a discussion about Pokemon Battle Troze and then you end with like, oh, here's some details about Mario fucking Kart 8.
Yeah, like, I feel like we shouldn't even mention this in the show notes for the episode.
No, I think that this will be a little prize for everyone who's made it through this 15-minute segment. Enjoy.
Yeah. I think that's it. If you have any questions about Mario Kart, feel free to hop on the website and ask us in the comments or hit us up on Twitter, connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. Yeah.
All that stuff. Or if you have questions about Pokemon Battle Trails, which you won't. You won't have any questions.
It's pretty straightforward.
Right. Well, Neil, thank you for being here. And we will talk to you guys later.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Alright, and that will do it for episode 128 of Connectivity. As always, you can send us your listener mail to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. You should be sure to rate and review us on iTunes if you haven't done so yet, and follow all of us on Twitter. Go to nintendoworldreport.com and look for the Twitter sidebar on the right-hand side of the page to find our usernames there. And be sure to support Colt County on Kickstarter if you haven't done so yet. Now, if you'd like, please stick around for a bonus segment all about the finale of How I Met Your Mother. We'll see you next week.
Welcome to a fun little bonus segment here on Connectivity. I'm Neil Ronahan, and with me is Zach Miller.
Hey.
And we're here to talk about the series finale for How I Met Your Mother.
Must we?
Wasn't really planning on this, but Zach and I have a special kind of vitriol to share with all of you in a short bonus segment. For those who don't know, How I Met Your Mother was a show that aired on...
CBS. Yeah,
it aired on CBS. It is now in the past tense. It's done for 9 years. And for a long time, it was one of my favorite shows on TV.
I know, nine years, right? Holy cow.
Retroactively, I fucking hate it. the finale, I thought, had some good moments.
No.
And I think the last season in general... had some good things about it, but I feel like they focused on the wrong things.
Yeah, and they betrayed every character in the finale. Yeah.
So we're just going to go character by character and then end up on the whole titular mother stuff that I think is where the show completely fucking falls apart.
Yeah.
So let's start with the static ones. Lillian Marshall, played by Allison Hannigan and Jason Segel.
Good lord.
I don't know if I have
even in the episode.
Yeah, that's true. But also, I mean, that's kind of the role for the past season or two because they haven't had as much to do.
That's true. But you know what? But here's the thing about it. In the final episode, like, you didn't say this before, but it skips ahead like 7 years, year by year. And you know, it's like all of a sudden they're having a third kid. All of a sudden he's going to be a Supreme Court justice. All of a sudden, you know, they're moving to Rome. What the fuck? And it's just, everything happened, but nothing happened.
Yeah, because the way that the last episode is an hour-long episode, and that past season, for those who haven't seen it, and I feel like if you're listening to this, you probably haven't seen it, or you don't give a shit, which is why we're going to explain it. And it should be, go without saying, lots and lots of spoilers. Tons of spoilers. We're going to spoil the whole damn thing. But, like, they make this big to-do over certain things, like, you know, oh, is Marshall going to be, Marshall got an offer for a judge, oh, he has to compromise, oh, but he gets it anyway, and then he becomes a Supreme Court justice, which is totally fine, and I kind of found it funny how everyone else is kind of spinning their wheels, and Marshall's just very quietly, like, just
moving
going through his entire career arc, but then at the same time in the finale, Lily basically is just, like, a baby maker.
Yeah.
This finale, to an extent, I feel like this is a, I don't feel it's a major issue, but it is worth pointing out how, the women kind of do jack shit.
Yep.
And everything's driven by men in this final episode.
That's
and
true.
I would say on the whole, the show's done a good job of not doing that. You know, they have a cast of three guys and two girls, and, you know, yeah, you know what, Ted is the main character, so sometimes it'll be a little more male driven. But they did a pretty good job balancing that, except for this finale where Lily is reduced into a baby maker.
And crying for one scene.
Yeah, and I think a little bit of that has to do with it. There really hasn't been that much to do for Lily and Marshall. But, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I still think they're fine characters. I don't think they really get totally assassinated in this finale because they're not really there. They're not really there.
Yeah.
And then we get to Barney and Robin. The entire last season was built around the weekend that Barney and Robin got married. And in the finale, within like 10 minutes, we find out that they get divorced 3 years later.
It's like, why did you even get married?
Yeah. It's like, why did you have this huge buildup over it?
Whole season. Really?
Yeah. And then over the course of the finale, you see Barney go to becoming a womanizer again, and then he comes back because...
He accidentally gets a woman pregnant, who you never meet,
yeah,
by the way.
Just never even her see her. Number 31, which is fueling speculation because there still is How I Met Your Dad, which is going to have a pilot.
Yeah, but I read today that show's not going to have anything in common with Mortgage Mother.
But the Barney thing
just ended so bizarrely.
Yeah, because he goes back to his womanizing ways after getting divorced with Robin, and then he, you know, goes into it hard, but then has a daughter, and then falls in love with his daughter.
And that's the last time you see Barney.
Yeah.
It's just so weird to me.
I do. I mean, I think it's a testament to Neil Patrick Harris, who plays Barney, his ability that I think he really does sell that scene where he sees the baby for the first time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but they needed a season to build that up.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they wasted the season on him and Robin. Because,
and they also focus so much around that fucking wedding where it's just like, if they just made it like, things are happening in quadruple time and they're going through, like, I wish they could parse this out over an entire season because then it might solve some of the huge glaring issues with this where now we're getting to the characters where those are evident with. Robin's role in the finale is just being a miserable sack of shit who, it gets really career driven and everyone thinks she's a cold, stupid bitch.
Yeah.
But for some reason, Ted's future children love her. Because we find out that basically the entire point of the show is not really how I met your mother. It's how I talked my kids into letting me bone Aunt Robin 6 years after my wife died.
Yeah.
Because they have, you know, a kind of good monologue from Ted at the end of it. Where he's talking about love and all that jazz, and then it just ends and, you know, and when your mom got sick. And I don't even think that he ever utters, like, you know, when your mom died. Like, I mean, obviously the kids know that their mother's dead.
Right.
And we find out that she gets sick and died, but it's, like, done in such a flippant way.
Like, no time at all. Like, 1 minute they're happy. Oh, and by the way, Neil, you know, he's like a diehard romantic. Gina brought this up. My wife, he's a diehard romantic. He always has been for the whole show. They're engaged for like 5 years and then just get married on a random Thursday. Like, come on.
I mean, like what kills me a lot about it too, is that I really, I did not watch every single episode of the past season. I kept up on it though. And I would kind of, whenever some cool shit happened, I'd pop in, see what was going on. I really liked what they did with the mother character.
She should have been a character. Like she was barely in the finale.
Yeah, I mean, and I just think they did a good job of, you know, basically forcibly inserting this character into the group and it worked.
Yeah.
And I feel like part of the reason how it winds up where the show is about, you know, Ted pining for Robin and then ending up with Robin after his wife dies is because I feel like the creators, to an extent, didn't want to gamble on what if people don't like the mother. And that's why I think they were really reserved with her throughout the season.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And I think that was kind of like, I don't know, a shitty bet. And it's also, as I'm sure you might know, Zach, how they have the crap where, they filmed, you know, the scene with the kids. So they knew this was the end game since season two.
Right.
Because they filmed these stuff with the kids at the end back in season two, which adds for a kind of weird little bit of CGI dumbness where you have the kids from 2006 talking to Ted from present day.
Right. And the kids haven't aged at all. They actually did a fairly good job of aging the characters, I thought.
I disagree. Some characters more than others. Like, I did like how, like, Ted and Marshall would just get gray hair.
Yeah.
Lily would have ridiculous wigs, and, like, the mother and Robin never seemed to change.
Yeah, that's true.
If you do the math, Robin's supposed to be, like, 50.
Oh, really?
At the end of that. Because you think it's, like, 2030.
Oh, you're right.
And all they do that is, like, oh, let's give her another haircut. Like...
Yeah. Yeah, it was just so...
Yeah, well, I guess she would have been, like, mid to late 40s, because I think all the characters... Like, they turned 30 in, like, 2008, or around that.
Oh, okay. Age. Yeah, so, yeah, it was around the same time. I don't know, man. It was just a bad way to end the show. Like, it's like they tried to cram a full season into an hour.
Yeah. And, I mean, I just...
no emotional resonance to anything that happened.
It just really bugged me. And, I mean, it's the flippantness that it goes from being... Oh, you know, love is wonderful. Oh, yeah, your mom got sick and died. And then the kid just being totally okay with, like, hey, Dad, you should go fuck Aunt Robin.
And they're all about it, too. And he's like, really? Should I?
Yeah. And, I mean, to me, it cheapens the build-up to everything. Everything
kinda
about
the pet.
Kind of
cheapens the whole show.
Yeah, like, I mean, because... It's like you're building up to this one thing, and then at the end they're like, oh, no, we were just kidding. We were building up to something else.
Yeah.
And you laid all these cards out, and I feel like something that, you know, the creators were trying to do is having, like, oh, you know, that's life. Life happens in unexpected ways. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, you can't really have, like...
The title of the show can't be a red herring.
It's a fucking sitcom. And, like, granted, they have had their good moments. Like, you know, the episode where Marshall's dad died, like, handled really well.
Oh, yeah.
And I just don't think they handled this well. And I think there's a way, like, you know, if they did split out what happened over the course of the finale to even a half season, I think it could have been a lot better. Because if you did have something where, like, you know, the mother dies and then, like, Ted's grieving for an episode.
I know. He didn't grieve at all.
Yeah.
It was literally, mom died.
Yeah.
Let's go bone Aunt Robin.
Yeah, and I understand that, I mean, there is a 6-year gap between when the mom dies and he's telling the story. So, you know, you take a step back and you're like, okay, you know, it has been 6 years. Kids seem to be okay with it. He seems to be okay with it. They're just really well adjusted. but you don't see that as a viewer. So it's just like, it kind of comes out of left field. And I mean, it's not like they were really shy about that. They were hinting towards this, because considering that, you know, most of this has been about how, like, Ted and Robin, are they destined together? No, it's Barney and Robin, but Ted still likes Robin. And, like, they made a couple veiled references to the mom possibly dying in a couple other episodes.
Right.
But it's just a bummer.
It really is.
Because I really did enjoy the show, and I do think that the finale just kind of shits on everything that came before it. Because there's part of me that's curious to see some episodes and seeing if knowing what happens at the end colors it. But I don't think I ever want to watch the show again.
No, and you know, the sad thing for me is, like, you know, Lily and Marshall do kind of end on a more or less, you know, happy note. They're kind of just bland.
Yeah.
What really killed the show, the worst part of the episode for me was what they did with Barney. Like, he does a 180 degree thing. Like, out in the waiting room, remember, there the nurse comes in and says, you know, we have news, and he says, I'm not the father, yay.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, just kidding. And then a second later, he is all about this baby, and that's the last thing you see of Barney. And 9 seasons of Barney not being that at all really bugged me.
Yep.
And he got married to Robin, for God's sake, and then now he's not anymore.
Yeah.
Ugh. Ugh.
I didn't like it much.
Yeah, it was not good.
But yeah. I think that might be all about
What was your least favorite part of the show?
I mean, really? Probably when Ted has a shit-eating grin holding up the fucking blue smirk
penis.
God,
that was so fucking stupid.
Because it's also, like, I don't know, over the course of the show, at least as far as I got it, was that, like, there was a reason why Robin and Ted didn't work out.
I know. It would have worked out by now if it was going to work out.
And also, especially when you saw Barney and Robin together, and it seemed like they came to a pretty good resolution.
Yeah.
And then, you know, okay, I get it. You know, you do want to have like, oh, they were really happy. And then 3 years later, they weren't. Like, you know what? Shit like that does happen. And while the abruptness of that does cheapen the entire season because it was focused on the fucking wedding, you know, I can kind of get that. But it's just like that whole like, oh, now Robin's just pining for Ted all the time. And it's not like they telegraphed how this was going to end, but it's just like, it just didn't work.
No, it didn't have any resonance because it happened 10 minutes later.
Yep.
So, fuck it.
Yeah. And then there's all this. Did you see anything? I mean, I don't know how much of the past season you did watch, but with the whole shit with, like, the mother having the love of her life from when she was, like, 21.
I did see that episode, but I don't remember much of it.
Yeah. And I don't, like... I have seen some stuff on the internet where people are talking about, it's like, well, the mother's with her true love, and now Ted's with hers. I'm like, no, that's a load of shit.
Oh, Christ.
Like, I'm sorry. There were a lot of things I liked when I was 21 that changed. Although, I mean, I guess I've been with the same woman since before I was 21. So.
Me too.
So maybe nothing does change now. But yeah. If you want to talk with me and Zach about this anymore, you can hit us up on Twitter.
Yeah.
I'm at Enron10. Zach, you are?
At ZMiller1902.
Yeah. Or you can find us at PAX East next weekend.
Oh, yeah.
In Boston. And we can go, well, Zach doesn't drink, but we can go have a beer and talk about the finale to How I Met Your Mother.
Amen.
And video games and play some fucking GameCube. See what's going on at the Renegade Kid booth down on the floor.
Yes.
You know, we can go play some board games, hang out, have a good time.
That'd be
get
awesome.
Some dim sum, you know, that jazz. yeah. So, if you want to bug us about it, go for it. If not, then.
That's cool.
Yeah. Whatever.
Yep.
We got this out now. We vented.
We did. And now it we're felt good.
Yep.
I'm never watching that show again.
Yeah, yeah. Now I need to find a new show to watch and then get mad when it ends.
Archer.
Oh, man. Yeah, we should start talking about Archer now.
Yeah, man.
Although I haven't had, maybe we'll bark down that tree another time. If you want to hear us talk about Archer, send in some listener mail to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com because maybe we'll do that because that show's fantastic.
It's really good.
All right. Bye.
Bye.